Well, happy Valentine's Day. I know. I'm a week late, I know, but here's the thing. I was all studied up. I was so excited to teach on Valentine's Day because I've actually never done that, and I had this whole message all planned out, and I was so excited, and then church got canceled last Wednesday. I was like, oh man, I'm not going to get to teach that for like 7 more years until it's on Valentine's Day again, you know? And so I thought, hey, why can't I just teach it next Wednesday? So originally this message was planned for the day of Valentine's Day, but you know, every day is Valentine's Day with God, right? He loves you every day. So I just figured, why not share it today? So we're going to be studying in Ruth tonight. As I told you, you guys can turn there if you like. One thing that I really like about Valentine's Day, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy, you know, just hanging with my wife on Valentine's Day. It's a lot of fun. We got to go to dinner, actually. We went to the Elephant Bar. Have you guys ever been there? So good. So good. If you guys haven't been to the Elephant Bar, you should go. It was a lot of fun. But it's a lot of fun. But one thing that I really like that pertains to you guys about Valentine's Day is that every year, Valentine's Day marks my anniversary here at Calvary. So last Friday, February 16th, was 3 years that I've been the youth pastor here with Velocity. And it just reminds me every year how much I love you guys. So I just wanted to remind you guys of that because I was reminded of it. Now, a lot of people get real into Valentine's Day. I don't know if you guys notice this. Maybe some of you guys do. Maybe some of you don't. I read that the total expected spending for Valentine's Day was almost $17 billion just in the United States. It's a lot of money. In fact, on average, guys spent on their lady friends $156.22. Now, Jen, I'm sorry, I did not spend $156.22 on you, but So guys on average spend that much. Girls on average spend about half that, $85.08. I guess the guys just totally get ripped off on Valentine's Day, you know. But and then I also read that in the United States, there's 189 million roses that are grown and produced just for Valentine's Day alone. 74% of those are bought just by guys. Now, how many guys bought roses? Anybody? For your mom or your significant other. Okay, nice. Your sister. Nice. You guys are such good brothers, I'm sure. I also found out, now how many of you guys like conversation hearts? Anybody? Those little heart candy things? Yeah, Dylan likes because they have sugar. Anything with sugar. Very nice. So 8 billion conversation hearts are produced for Valentine's Day. 8 billion. Now, just to give you an idea of how many that is, there's actually a city in Arizona called Valentine. Okay? Valentine, Arizona, that city, if you stretched out 8 billion conversation hearts end to end, starting in the city of Valentine, Arizona, you went all the way to Rome, Italy, that would be just the start. Because 8 billion would stretch from Valentine, Arizona to Rome, Italy, and back 20 times, okay? Can you believe that? So that is a lot of conversation hearts. Obviously, people love those things. 8 billion of them produced. Now, when you guys were growing up, there were probably different things that you did. I remember my preschool class or whatever, and there was like sandwich bags all over the wall, and you got to like put your little cards in there, writing nice things on it, you know, like you have nice hair and your left eye is really neat, you know, and I like your kneecap and different things like that, right? And then, you know, sometimes on Valentine's Day, you like write the name of the person that you think is cute on your hand and you like hide it. Oh, you know, and it's just so great to look at your hand. So a lot of people really get into the day Valentine's Day. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who don't. Okay. In fact, I even found a website that you can buy anti-Valentine's Day merchandise. Okay. Check out some of these. Says, I hate pink and flowers and love. That's it. Okay? Check out this next one. It says, Cupid, the other white meat. Nice. Check out this next one. Cupid is stupid. And then probably the worst one, all I want for Valentine's Day is a divorce. Now, if you're married and your spouse wears that shirt, good luck. That's all I got to say. But speaking of divorce on Valentine's Day, I even read, this is awful, I couldn't believe this, but I read that a radio station in Pennsylvania was giving away a free divorce to the caller who was able to write the best poetry about how much they hated their spouse. Can you believe that? Isn't that awful? On Valentine's Day, on their website, it said, love stinks or something like that. And it was, they would pay for you to divorce your spouse on Valentine's Day. So, you can tell that there's some people who get into it, some people obviously who don't get into it. Well, whether you're a hater or you're a celebrator, it doesn't matter, because Valentine's Day is a great way to remind yourself of God's love. 1 John 4:8, you guys have heard it. The tail end of the verse says that God is love. God is love. It's not that God likes love. It's not that God, thinks that love is a good idea. God, in his very definition, is love. If we had a heavenly dictionary, I think we could look up the word love and it would be defined as God. Because we all say that we love certain things, but our love doesn't even compare to the love that God has for us. You know, and we give cards and we give chocolates and we give flowers. And those are great ways to show love and all. But check out what Jesus said. John 15:13. Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. And if anybody showed that, it was Jesus. Jesus was the perfect example of somebody who proved what love is by laying down his life for those he loved. And he didn't just say it. That's the great thing. He proved it. And that's why tonight I've entitled the message, A Public Display of Affection. Make sure you guys are in the book of Ruth. We'll be reading there in just a few minutes. I was actually at a concert on Monday night, and there were some people very publicly, disgustingly displaying their affection to each other. I'm sure you guys have seen that at school and elsewhere. And I almost threw up 17 times in my mouth. It was disgusting, you know. Now, that kind of public display of affection is not what I'm talking about tonight, okay? The public display of affection that I'm talking about tonight is the fact that the one true living God came to earth, gave it all up for us. There is no bigger display of love. Now, I mentioned this is going to wrap up, this study tonight is going to wrap up our series on Chicks Who Rocked It. Women, you know, great examples. Some good, some not so good. We've learned actually from a few great ones. Just a little recap, we learned about Mary, Jesus' mother. She was just an ordinary woman who was used for extraordinary things. And we learned that God has the same plan for you as well. We also learned about Esther. You guys may remember Esther. She was obedient and she was available. And God used that. She was ready, she was courageous, and she believed in God's timing. And God honored that. We also studied just a couple weeks ago about Lydia. You guys may remember Lydia. And in Christ, she was the first one to come to Christ. But she believed in him, even though she was the only one. And through her, a new church was started on a whole new continent. And the gospel continued to spread. So we learned from some great examples. We also learned from some not so great examples. One was Jezebel. You guys may remember her. She put herself first. And in the end, she paid for it. You guys remember the way she died? It was dirty, right? She like fell down off the wall and then her blood splattered and dogs licked it up. And all the guys were all, yeah, that's awesome, you know. We also learned about Martha, who, for the most part, is a great example. But in the story we looked at, we learned that she was too busy at this point trying to do ministry than actually just hanging out with Jesus. And that was what really mattered. We also learned from the woman who was caught in adultery. That was our first study in this series. And it wasn't necessarily that we looked at her life and how to pattern our life, but we learned about Jesus's forgiveness for this woman, that he didn't condemn her. So lots of great women in the Bible. Of course, there's no way I could probably ever teach about every single one of them, but we hopefully hit some of your favorites and maybe you learned some new stuff as well. So tonight we kind of wrap it up with Ruth. And just to kind of set the time period here, Ruth was alive during the book of Judges, okay? Now the book of Judges is the book to the left. You probably see part of it when you turn to Ruth. But just kind of how they're living in the time of Judges is a dangerous way to live. You guys may know they're kind of going through a period of cycling back and forth between serving God and living for themselves, and serving God and living for themselves. And then they start living for themselves. And then things get really bad. And so they cry out to God, God, save us. So God saves them, brings in a judge. They start serving God again. Hey, God, everything's great. And then just a few years later, they go off the deep end again. They start living for themselves. They get mixed up with idolatry and sexual immorality and all kinds of stuff. And things go terrible, go down the drain again. So they call out to God. He saves them, brings a judge. And it's just this terrible cycle all throughout the book of Judges. In fact, look at Judges chapter 21, verse 25, just to give you an insight as to how these people lived in this day. It says, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that gives you a good idea of the way these people were living. They did whatever was right for themselves. Whatever they wanted to do, whatever was right in their own eyes, that's exactly what they did. Thankfully, Ruth was a big contrast to that. She was a light living in a dark world. And that's what we're going to see tonight. She was loyal, she was loving, she was servant-hearted. And through her life, as we'll see tonight, we'll see a picture of God's love for us through her and through the display of affection that was showed to her. So follow along with me, Ruth chapter 1, starting in verse 1. We're going to just kind of hit the highlights tonight. We don't have time to read through the whole book. I would encourage you to do so, though. It's only 85 verses long, the whole thing. But we're going to kind of skip around through it tonight. Ruth chapter 1, starting in verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, not Oprah, okay? And the name of the other was Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both of them, Mahlon and Chilion, also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Now, skip down with me to verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband. So she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. Verse 14. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And then verse 16. But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. Okay, so number one, tonight, by herself, Ruth was restless and abandoned. By herself, Ruth was restless and abandoned. Now, humans are created to be social people. We like hanging out with other people. We like having fun. We like being around friends. And there's a lot of things in life that you wouldn't want to try to do on your own. And even if you did do them on your own, it wouldn't be really a lot of fun. You know, for example, Monopoly, okay? Now, Monopoly is a lot of fun. But imagine trying to play the game on your own. You're like, hey, I'll buy a Park Place from you. I don't know. And you have like an auction with yourself, you know, rolling the dice. And it just wouldn't be all that fun, you know. A lot of different things like that in life. How about the game Twister? By yourself, that game wouldn't be all that fun, you know. I mean, you could try, but eventually once you get all twisted up, how are you going to spin the little thing again, you know? You kind of need somebody there to help you out. Ping pong. If you don't have a wall to bounce your ball against, it's going to be kind of tiring running around the table trying to play ping pong by yourself, you know? Or how about dodgeball? You ever tried to throw a ball at yourself and dodge it at the same time? Doesn't work too well, right? I don't know how about you guys, but I like to play Marco Polo in the pool. I've never tried by myself, but I'm sure it wouldn't be that fun. Can you imagine? Marco Polo, Marco Polo. Oh, I gotcha. You know, I mean, it'd be so easy and so stupid at the same point, you know. So there's a lot of things in life that you just don't want to do on your own. And one of those things is life itself. In fact, all the way back in the Garden of Eden, God looked at Adam and said, "It is not good for man to be alone." And to that I say, amen. Because I'm thankful that God has provided me with a beautiful wife, with friends, with family. I don't like to be on my own. And there are times that we enjoy time on our own, but for the most part, we are built as social people. And Ruth here finds herself restless and abandoned on her own. She's by herself. Things have been rough lately for her family, for Naomi's family, who's her mother-in-law, because you guys have just read with me, but Naomi, her mother-in-law, has just gone through a wide range of emotions. First of all, we read that her husband died. What a terrible, terrible tragedy. She went through sadness and mourning. But then, after that, her sons get married. I'm sure she was so excited, rejoicing with them. And then, a few years later, both sons die. So now, all of her closest family, her husband and her two sons, are dead. They've died from whatever took over them. And you may remember back from when we learned about the woman Tabitha, who was also a widow. We learned that widows in the Bible times especially had it really rough. A lot of times it was really hard for them. They were often looked down on by society. People often just kind of kicked them to the side, didn't provide anything for them. In fact, when their husband died, they couldn't even inherit the things that their husband owned. It went to the next male in the family. And so it made it very hard for a woman when her husband died first, because she was left without sometimes a house, without land. Sometimes they were forced to sell themselves into slavery just to pay their debts. And so you can imagine how devastating it would be. A woman in America can continue to go on and thrive even. But in these times, they were left completely alone. And so this was a hard, hard thing to go through. And that's exactly where not only Naomi finds herself, but our character tonight, Ruth. She finds herself devastated, abandoned, restless. She doesn't know what to do. Things are up in the air. She doesn't have money. Her father-in-law is dead. Her mother-in-law is weeping. Her sister-in-law is mourning the loss of her husband. Her husband himself is dead. She has no money. She has no food. It says that they were in the middle of the famine when this happened. So I don't think we can even imagine the emotions and the things that Ruth is going through here. But she's dealing with it. And by herself, Ruth is restless and abandoned. She can't go on like that. She has no hope. She has no money, no food, no joy. But thankfully, she's just about to meet somebody who's going to change all that. Look in chapter 2, verse 1. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. Nice name. Boaz. So Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him, in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Number two, by his side, she was rested and assured. By his side, she was rested and assured. Now, it's always good, like I mentioned, to have people by our side. One example of that is when I was real young, every once in a while I had nightmares. And you guys know how it is. You think for sure somebody's in your house, you know, whether it's a monster or some dude you saw on TV that escaped from prison. He obviously came to your house and is in your closet. You know how it is, right? And so you freak out, and it's always good to have somebody there. Maybe it's your little teddy bear, you know, or even better, it's somebody who actually is living, and it's your dad, you know, who you think is like the biggest, toughest guy ever in the world and could beat up anybody, you know. Now, I've heard of some pretty crazy nightmares before. I heard of one of my friends who he was dreaming, but he didn't realize he was dreaming. He was dreaming that he had to go to the bathroom really bad. He was running all over the place trying to find a place to go. And he runs into the store, and in the back of the store, the bathrooms are in the back upstairs. So he sprints to the back. Well, he starts to climb the stairs, and he notices that there's water pouring down from the ceilings. And so he runs up the stairs, and he just tromps through all this water to get to the bathroom, and then he wakes up wet. That's a nightmare, okay? That is a nightmare right there. I also, my mom one time woke us all up in the house because she was going like this in her sleep. And my dad was like, "What's wrong?" And she was like, "Oh." She told us what her dream was. In her dream, she had wings, okay? She was flying through our house, and she flew down the hall into the living room. Unfortunately, her wings got stuck in the ceiling fan, and she woke up as she was hitting the ceiling, and the floor, and the ceiling fan was just throwing her down to the floor, and she was bouncing off the fan and the floor. So it woke her up. Crazy, huh? So we have nightmares every once in a while. In fact, I remember one show my family and I used to watch, old school. It's called Rescue 911. Have you guys ever watched that? Okay, Chris is a fan, all right. We used to actually record this show, believe it or not. We wanted to see it so much. And basically what they did was they reenacted 911 calls and all the things that happened, okay? I remember there were certain ones that I would watch. It would be like a robbery happening, and it would be like the scared lady under the bed calling 911, freaking out. Every night, without fail, after I watched a robbery one, I had nightmares. And you guys know the feeling, right? You're laying in bed in like a cold sweat. Your eyes are open. You're sure you saw somebody in the hall, you know. And you don't want to move because they might see you. And I remember so many times counting to three in my head. Okay, when I get to three, I'm going to jump up. One, two, oh, I can't do it. Oh. You know, and you get really scared, and one, two, I can't do it, you know, and you're breathing heavy and you're sweating, and then you get to three, and I threw off my covers and I ran into my dad's bedroom. Dad, I think there's somebody in the house. You're like, okay, son, I'll go check. Takes baseball bat, you know. Son, nope, nobody's in the house. Okay, Dad, but I know I saw somebody. Dad, I did. They walked by my door. I know it, you know? And so every once in a while, he would say, all right, if you can't get back to sleep, let me just come lay in your bed next to you so that if somebody attacks you, I'll be there, you know? And it was so comforting to have him there. Now, unfortunately, there were times that I got sad when that happened because he snored really loud and I couldn't sleep, you know? But for the most part, it was always very comforting having him by my side, knowing that someone was there to protect me and provide for me. It was a relief. And what a relief this must have been for Ruth. Here she is without a job, without money, without food. She doesn't know what her future holds. And then she meets this guy who's a relative of the family named Boaz. He's a very wealthy man. And for Ruth, he goes by a specific title, okay, in the book of Ruth. It's called the Kinsman Redeemer, okay? Basically what it is a person who is closely related to Ruth. So he's a kinsman, he's related. And then he's a redeemer. And the kinsman redeemer part of it is that he would do his best to help her along after the death of her husband. She was closely related to him, and he would do his best to help her pay debt and all of that kind of thing. So it was their duty as the kinsman redeemer, as a close relative, to help the widow come out of poverty. In fact, as I mentioned, a lot of times a widow would have to sell herself into slavery. And so the kinsman redeemer would be there to help her, to provide a place for her to stay. Maybe give her money, maybe completely pay off all her debt. Whatever it was, he would pay for her freedom. And so it just so happens, not really a coincidence at all, but it just so happens that Boaz is related to Naomi's former husband, Elimelech, which puts him very closely related to Ruth. And it also just so happens, although obviously not a coincidence, that Ruth ends up in his field, picking barley and gathering food. So listen to what Boaz says to Ruth in chapter 2, verse 8. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "You will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field." Now, gleaning is like the process of following the reapers and picking up stuff that they dropped, gathering food. So he says, "Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." So she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" Verse 11, "And Boaz answered and said to her, 'It has been fully reported to me, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and you have come to a people whom you did not know before.'" Verse 12, "The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." So there were laws in this land, thankfully for Ruth, that made it where these people had to provide their best or do their best to help these widows. What they had to do was they had to, as they were going out into their fields, they couldn't pick all of the barley or all of the grain. They had to leave the corners of the field to allow widows and poor people to come and get food. They also, if they dropped something on the ground, they couldn't pick it back up. That was part of the law. The poor people, the widows, were able to come in behind them and get all their leftovers, gather it. And that's what is called gleaning. So Ruth is having a great time. Continue on in verse 13. "Then she said, 'Let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants.' Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, 'Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. And when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. Also let grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her.' So she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley." So she's able to take home a bunch of food. And it's interesting to me to look at the contrast between chapter 1 and chapter 2. Look at the different words that are used here in chapter 1. Words like famine, died, wept, grieves, bitter, empty, afflicted. All of those are in chapter 1, when Ruth is on her own. She's by herself. But then look in chapter 2, the words that are used. Great wealth, favor, Lord be with you, bless you, notice, full reward, refuge, comforted, spoken kindly, satisfied, on and on and on. You can see the contrast of when she was by herself and when she was by his side. So by herself, she was completely restless and abandoned. But by Boaz's side, she was rested and assured. Well, thankfully, the blessings continue. Number 3, in his arms, she's restored and adored. So Naomi comes up with a plan for Ruth. She comes up with this interesting plan, okay? Now, read along with me and see what you think your reaction to this might be. Imagine your mother-in-law or your mom telling you to do this. Be a little strange. Chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down. And he will tell you what you should do." And she said to her, "All that you say to me, I will do." Okay, now, to me, this seems a little weird. You can imagine, or maybe, probably not, I can't imagine my mom telling me to do something like this. Hey, she might say to you, "Hey, I've got this plan, daughter. That guy is a really cute guy, all right? So here's what you're going to do. Head over to his field. When he's done working for the day, follow him. He's going to go eat. Don't let him know that you're there. Then after he's done eating, watch where he goes to sleep. Then when he goes to sleep, go in, uncover his feet, and lay down at his feet. And then when he wakes up, he'll tell you what to do." I'd be like, that's creepy. I don't think I want to do that, you know? Plus, his feet probably smell bad. I don't really know if I want to go there. Well, interestingly enough, in this day, this was a marriage proposal. Now, today, the guy usually gets down on his knee with a ring or some other something like that. But this was Ruth. What she was doing was, by uncovering his feet and laying at his feet, she was submitting herself to him. Because this is a very similar thing that a poor person or a servant would have done to their master. And so she is going and laying at his feet, saying, "I submit myself to you." In other words, take me under your wing. Cover me up. Protect me. In other words, you're cute and I want to marry you, okay? And so that is Naomi's plan. This was a marriage proposal. Look at verse 7. "And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled." I don't blame him. "And turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, 'Who are you?' So she answered, 'I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative.' Then he said, 'Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman.'" So she did exactly that. She laid at his feet, just like a servant would do. When he woke up, she asked him to cover her, which was just basically a sign of, take me under your wing, take care of me. And so Boaz gets the point, all right? Now, it says that he was startled at midnight. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I would be a little startled if I woke up and there was a random woman lying at my feet, you know? And my feet were really cold because she had uncovered it. Like, hey, put my blankets back on. What's going on, you know? At least hook me up with some socks or something. But she's just laying there. And it says that he's startled and says, who are you? And she says, I'm Ruth. I'm a close relative. And what she's saying is, you are the next of kin. You are my kinsman redeemer. And I'm asking you to redeem me, to help me, because I'm poor. I don't have a lot of things. So he gets the point. There's a problem, though. The problem is, there's somebody that's related even closer than Boaz is. Somebody that's related even closer. And it's always the closest relative's job to do the redeeming. It's not just anybody that's related, but it's the closest relative. So Boaz has to go and meet this other guy and tell him, hey, there's a widow. And this guy just died and we need to help redeem his land. And so he does. He goes and talks to the guy. And in fact, in the meantime, he gives Ruth a bunch of barley. She heads home. And now Boaz goes to take care of business. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, come aside, friend. Sit down here. So he came aside and sat down. Verse 2. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Now, the thing is, the gate of the city is the place of power in the Bible. And so when they would go to the gate, that was oftentimes where some of the most prosperous, influential people were at, the leaders of the city. So he went to the gate to take care of his business. The leaders of the city show up. Look at what he tells them. Verse 3. Then he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And he said, I will redeem it. So he goes and talks to this guy, and he says, yeah, sounds good. I'll take care of it. Verse 5, then Boaz says, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. And the close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times. This is actually kind of interesting. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. So the way that they took an oath, check this out. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was a confirmation in Israel. Okay, now that's kind of interesting. They do things a little interesting here. First, the wedding proposal was a little out of the ordinary. And then Boaz goes to take care of the business. The guy says, fine, we have a deal. Here you go. And he's like, oh, sweet, I'll give you mine. They trade sandals, okay? Now, I don't know, I'm sure you guys have done that every once in a while, traded shoes with a friend, and you look funny because you're walking like one's a high heel and one's a Converse, you know, or whatever, and you're walking around all funny looking. You got two shoes. Well, these guys, as they would wear these two shoes, it was a sign that they had made a covenant. Now, I don't know why they chose to do that, but that's the way they did it. And so he made this covenant. The people of the city, bless them. They get married. Look at verse 11. And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. And may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. So with Boaz, Ruth was restored And she was adored by her friends, by her family. The amazing thing to me is that the secret of Ruth's prosperity is found in this guy, in Boaz. And an interesting thing about the name Boaz, we read it and we kind of laugh at it, but it's a really cool name because it means in him is strength. And the source of her strength, the source of her prosperity is in him is strength. That's where she finds it. Now, as I mentioned, there's a lot of different ways people show their love for each other. A lot of different public displays of affection. I read about actually a Hollywood photographer. He bought a $1 million mansion for his fiance and then took her on a helicopter, and he had the day before had the house wrapped in wrapping paper, okay? 5,000 square feet of wrapping paper and a 75-foot bow. And they went up in the helicopter and he said, "Hey, that's weird. That house is all wrapped up." And he surprised his fiance with this $1 million mansion that way. Now, that's actually the way I bought Jen our first house. It was great. And she was really, you're laughing. Okay, that's not at all the way that I did it. So there's lots of different ways people go about it. I read about, this would actually, I think you guys would really like this. I read about a place in Belgium that people could go, and only on Valentine's Day they can do this. This bar is called the Pure Bar, and you could go to this place, and they offer tanks of helium that you can inhale. I knew you guys would be excited about that. Can you imagine? Happy Valentine's Day! You know? All these people talking in these high-pitched voices. They did have a warning, though. Don't inhale too much. You'll probably die, right? Doesn't sound very, very smart. A couple weeks ago, I told you guys about a guy named Rand Fishkin. Now, that's an interesting name. But he did his best to purchase a $2.5 million Super Bowl advertisement. In the middle of the Super Bowl, the 30-second commercial cost $2.5 million. So he did his best to get sponsors and raise all this money because what he had done was shot a commercial and he was going to propose to his girlfriend on this $2.5 million 30-second commercial during the middle of the Super Bowl. So he began a website. The website is called mysuperproposal.com, okay? And so what he was doing was trying to raise awareness and get sponsors to help him out, gain support. And I love the tagline that he has on his website. I checked it out. It says, he calls it the most public display of love in the history of mankind. And I thought, that's interesting. And then I thought, I wonder how many people watch the Super Bowl. How many people watch the Super Bowl? It turns out over 93 million people watch the Super Bowl. That's a lot of people watching this guy. Now, unfortunately, he didn't get his $2.5 million. He ended up raising enough money to play the commercial during a local airing of the show Veronica Mars, okay? And he bought the commercial, and I guess it's like his fiance's favorite TV show, and so they were watching it together. The commercial came on. Oh my gosh, yes! You know, everything was so exciting, and tears, and Kleenexes, and all that stuff, right? Well, I just thought it was so amazing that he calls this commercial the most public display of love in the history of mankind. Because I was reminded of John 3:16. You guys know it? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God so loved the world. An estimate of how many people have ever lived on the earth? Over 100 billion people. That's thousands of times more people than watch the Super Bowl for this guy. And yet he calls his commercial the biggest public display of history in the history of mankind. Well, I would say that Jesus' death for every single person who ever has lived or ever will live was absolutely the most public display of love in the history of mankind. And in many ways, this guy that we read about tonight, Boaz, is a great picture of Jesus. We can see ourselves, actually, throughout the book of Ruth. Because like Ruth, without Boaz, us without Christ, we were hopeless. Our future was up in the air. We had nothing. We had no one to go home to. Ephesians chapter 2 says that without Jesus Christ, you are dead in your sins. Not doing good, not sick. The Bible says without Jesus Christ in your life, you are dead. There's nothing good about you. People say, well, we were all born good. No, you weren't. We were all born with sin. The Bible tells us that very clearly. And just like Ruth without Boaz, we were hopeless. We had nothing. But Christ, just like Boaz, was our closest relative to God. And he redeemed us. He was our kinsman redeemer. Like Boaz, Jesus wanted to save us from a life of slavery. And so he paid the price so we didn't have to go through it. Like Boaz did for Ruth, Jesus paid the price for our freedom. But it wasn't by taking off his sandal, okay? It wasn't by paying a certain amount of money to get her a house or to have her live with him. Jesus paid with his life. Jesus paid with his life. We sang some awesome songs tonight. One of the lyrics that really caught my eye was that last song. It says, I am captured by this love that I see. I'm captured by it. And I hope you guys can see a little glimpse of the story of God's love for you guys tonight and be captured by it. We also sang tonight that I'll never know how much it cost to see my sin upon that cross. We never will. Jesus paid an incredible price. And he showed his love very clearly to us. And if Jesus so publicly displayed his love for us through death, it's time for us to publicly display our love for him through our life. It's time to start living it. It's time to understand that this life is worth so much more than we often make it out to be. Maybe tonight you realize you've been struggling with that. You haven't been living a public display of Christ's love for him or for anybody else. Tonight's the night to set that right. But let me also challenge you with this. Every one of us was born the way that we read about Ruth tonight. Abandoned, restless, on our own, no hope, no future. And without Jesus Christ, that's the way we all will end. And if you need tonight to make sure that you have a Redeemer, somebody who has paid the price to set you free, I know the guy. His name's Jesus. And he very publicly displayed his love for you. And so if you need to make sure you're right tonight with him, I want to encourage you to do that. There will be leaders up here at the end of the service that we want to talk to you and pray with you and make sure that you are strong in your relationship with the Lord. Because if you're not, it's a scary place to be. Put your faith in him. He loves you. He displayed it very clearly for you. Let's pray. Jesus, you are just so good to us. Tonight, I am captured by this love that I see in the 85 verses of the book of Ruth. We didn't even read half of them tonight. But I can see your love so clearly. And Jesus, I pray that our lives would be a public display of our affection for you. But not just our affection, not just our thinking you're nice, but our absolute undying love for you. Lord, that our lives would be a sacrifice, that our lives would be a great representation of your love for the rest of the world. And as you have so publicly displayed this affection for us, help us to go out tonight and tomorrow and the rest of the week and month and the rest of our lives, Lord, that our lives would be a public display of our love for you. We love you, Jesus. Be with us as we go tonight. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you, guys. Love you, guys. And if you need somebody to talk to, we'll have leaders up here at the front.